afternoon. Who needs a nap besides me? Oh, we'll do this hour and then we get to take a nap. I'm going to ask you this evening on the last session that we're going to do, that I'm going to ask you to give me 15 more minutes after the session, because I want us to do some writing, and you can't put that on tape because we're going to be just writing. So if you would allow me that, I would appreciate it. Okay, let's get back to this heavy-duty stuff we were doing on step four. You'll have the copy now, so you'll know how the categories break down. Okay, we're going to do our three inventories: the resentment inventory, the fear inventory, and the sex inventory. And when you get to their resentment, I am angry at, or I'm resentful at, the cause and what it affects. And then the fears is, what am I afraid of? Why am I afraid? What it affects, and what's my part in it, or what is the character defect? The sex inventory is, who have I harmed because of my sexual behavior? And again, I wanted to make that very clear, because of the people who have had sexual abuse as a child, that is not the same. That goes on the resentment inventory. And I think we need to be very honest, because I think a lot of times, if you're anything like me, being a woman, I would put myself in a victim role and not take responsibility for the stuff that I've done. And one of the things that I've learned is, if I want to get well in this program, I've got to be rigorously honest, which means I have got to accept responsibility for my actions, past and present. And that's the same as my feelings. I've got to accept them, past and present. They may very well have been justified, but I have to accept that they're my feelings. Okay, and after we do this, we're going to move on to step five, admit it to God, to myself, and to another human being. And we left off at the last session. I was getting ready to tell you about the part in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about who we give the inventory to. Now, I always tell the women that I work with that, you know, I am very happy to listen to your inventory. And I think a lot of times it's really good if you can have that kind of relationship. But there are a lot of people in this program who have been betrayed, who have had a lot of violation. And the book is very clear, and it says, select this person carefully. And you may want to give it to, you know, someone who is like your spiritual advisor, like a minister or a priest. Please know that that's okay to do that. The book says it's okay to do that. And I have to, you know, I always want to, you know, tell people that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, just because they've been here and they've been sober a long time, are not always, you know, totally honest. And that sometimes, if you're not really sure, if you hear somebody gossiping about somebody else and you know you have any indication that that might be in a fourth step, run like hell from that person if you have any consideration of giving a fifth step. Because it's very important that you do not, that you feel safe and that you do not have any feelings of betrayal. Because it's so important that we be rigorously honest. I mean, our lives are at stake here. This is not about making an AA sponsor happy. This is about saving my life. So, and the book is real clear about that. So it's like, I always say, when all else fails, go to the book. Don't take my word for it. Go to the book. And after having done that, now you've got your ledger sheet here. Now we go to step six. Being entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. And the book says, if we're not entirely ready to have all these character defects removed, now where are the character defects on our little paper here? Anybody know? The fourth column. That's our character defects. So why would you want to burn your inventory? This has all the information here. So if we burn the inventory, we get rid of, you know, then we don't have the information. So we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And it says, the book says, if we're not ready, to just continue to pray for the willingness to get ready. That doesn't mean that you can't take the step. Because what we're going to do is we're probably ready to have most of them removed. But maybe there's a few we're not ready to have removed. And then step 7 says, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. That's it. Now, there's a guy in our AA group at home. His name is Frank H. Great guy. He's just, if he won't let us make him a guru, because in case anybody didn't know, gurus are self-appointed. And he won't let us make him a guru, but he's been around for a while, and he's always saying, if you don't like, you know, the way I'm acting, I've asked God to remove it. He just hasn't. Because that's what the step says. Ask God, just humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And then the book says, we have completed step 7. Now, if you think you have any power, I was told, Polly, if you think you have any power to remove your shortcomings, think again. Only God can remove our shortcomings. What has been my experience is I get this whole series of opportunities to get rid of my shortcomings. That has been my experience. But I do not have the power in which to remove my shortcomings. Only God has. So, you know, you can take a deep breath and know that if you've asked him, that probably what you're going to get is a series of opportunities to grow. Step 8. Made a list of all the persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now, where's the list? The first column of the inventory. So it's all laid out in your inventory. It's a ledger sheet. It's an inventory. And then step 9 is made direct amends whenever possible. Finish the step for me. Made direct amends. When hurt my... Right. Thank you. Just drew a blank. Now, I want to talk about step 9. I think that in order for me to be set free, I need to be willing to make direct amends. And it has also been my experience that when I see somebody that is stuck, that I believe that there's two places where is the cause of being stuck. And do you know what I'm referring to when I say stuck? Okay, just can't seem to move forward, can't seem to get any better. Just, you know, just like, oh my God, what am I doing? I feel like I'm doing everything right. That it's two places. It's either fourth step or ninth step. That those are the places where we become stuck. But it's those two places of which the ego is at risk, are those two spots. And I know for me that if I'm not willing to make direct amends, that I can be stuck. Now, a lot of times we say, well, such and such did more to me than I did to them. And I was reading in the book today, and I just like to... Can I take my book back upstairs? Oh, I have. I can't remember exactly what page it's on, but let's see if I can, while we're talking. And it's talking about that sometimes it was talking about making amends for just how I felt about that person. You know, that is important too, because a lot of times how we feel about somebody can certainly keep us from having a very good relationship with that person. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Does anybody have any trouble understanding that? because see, this was my, and I'm, you know, I probably had more arguments than anyone because I'm a very prideful person. I certainly didn't like to admit that, but I find out that that's me, and I would say to my AA sponsor, but I didn't hurt them. And she would say, did you have ill feelings toward them? Well, of course I had ill feelings. Then you make amends for that. Because what happens is that we get, you know, we have these invisible walls that are in front of us. And if I want to have freedom, and if I want to be happy, joyous, and free, then I've got to start tearing down these walls brick by brick. And a lot of times it's really very difficult for me to go up to a person and say, you know, I'm really sorry about how I felt about you. And I have done a lot of harm to people by talking behind their back. I'm very bad about that. And it seems like I can just get into a really good character defect and I can really start talking about people. And it's gossipy, and we can laugh, you know, a whole bunch of us get together and say, well, they never take their inventory, so somebody has to. And, you know, those kind of attitudes and just really start gossiping. And what happens is I begin to feel ickier and ickier and ickier. And I have found out that the person who suffers from that the most is me. So it's really necessary for me to make amends for how I felt about a person. Just feelings. And the book tells me to do that. And what happens is I get to bring more bricks down one by one and become happy, joyous, and free. And the book is very clear to say that we don't tell them about their shortcomings. You know, they may or may not ever get into recovery. They may or may not ever get a sponsor. They may or may not ever be sitting in a retreat like this saying, you know, and I used to say things like, well, if I've got to get so damn good, why don't they have to get good too? Because I wanted everybody else to be having to do this hard job too. But see, I'm not responsible for another person's spiritual condition. I am only responsible for mine. And what I have tried to learn is that each and every person, whether I like them or not, whether they're a good person or not, is God's kid. And it is my responsibility to make amends to that person so I remain spiritually fit. I am only responsible for my spiritual condition. That's all. So it's necessary that I do that. Please, please, any amends that you're going to make, talk them over with somebody, with your AA sponsor, an AA sister, someone in the program, because it is not okay to go make amends to your ex-lover's wife. You know, we never get to be free at someone else's expense. All our amends are not to harm others. And if anything that's going to happen is going to harm somebody else, then you get to pack that one. You know, talk to another friend about them, but you can't take that one and go to the person. Because it's not right to hurt anybody else. We're supposed to be easy on others, the book says, and hard on ourselves. We don't do things that hurt other people. Now, I agree. There's a lot of people out there, certainly in my life, that deserve hurting. But it's not my job to do it. That's not my job. I am not the person who is their judger, nor am I the person who is to be their punisher. And that was really hard for me because I felt like somebody ought to do it, and it might as well be me. So make sure that you talk things over. Does anybody have any questions on that? Yes.
It was out. You didn't like a person, and there was. You just can't look at this as a donkey for a whole lot of years. Or, you know, I get real confused on that because a lot of people are real violent. That would mean I didn't talk in front of them.
Okay.
I get even and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. What she's saying is, what do you do with a person who you don't like? And you didn't like them, you were really silent, and you had the feelings inside, even though you didn't tell them. How do you make amends to them?
Because I imagine they could tell by my
actions
that I didn't like being around them or being there, but then they actually said or did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I think in a situation like that, and you know, you can talk it over after you do the amends, you know, when you do the inventory with whoever you choose to discuss it with. But what I would do is I would just say, you know, I'm really sorry for my behavior. Sometime I became very quiet, and I'm sure that, you know, and that might have offended you. And for that, I'm really sorry. You don't have to go tell somebody, you know, what a rotten SOB they are. That's why I was acting like that. So, but other words, you make, what you're going to do is you're going to make restitution for your behavior. Because in a sense, you had a lot of control over that person and probably knew it by your behavior. I know I certainly did. I could control a lot of people by sitting there and pouting. They knew I was angry. And I just played with it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm awake. Did you still? I keep walking around. I'm sorry. I don't know what to do with this confinement with these mics. I'm sorry. Yes.
Another thing for me,
she said, after I make the amends, then I have to live the amends. In other words, treat the person kindly and act as if I'm sincere about the amends. The book says that. That we are supposed to treat that person with kindness and consideration. In other words, it's kind of like, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk about love. We get a lot of mixed messages, a lot of us who come to this program. Somebody says, I love you, and they punch your face in.
Yeah.
You know, somehow or another, I don't think that's love. If I love someone, I act as if I love someone. That love is an action. And amends is a living amends also. Just because I say it, if I go and say, I'm sorry about the feelings I had about you and my silence, and then I go outside and I start saying, well, I made amends to her, but you know, and just start taking your inventory again, I am not living it, and I am not going to have any relief from it, and you're going to know it. I mean, isn't it just amazing how we all have this little sensor in here, and you just know? I call it my God spot, and I think this little spot in here, and the longer we're sober and the more we practice step 11, the more intense this little, you know, this little voice gets, and you just know when somebody means what they say or if they're just there to look good. See, that way we'd have to inventory that, because there we go manipulating again. You know, one more time, I'm manipulating to get your approval. Man, it's hard to stay sober. Any other questions? Yes.
I was wondering earlier you said, like, if you're a child, you're not responsible. How do you know when that fine line is in your adult and a child, like, is there about sexual abuse?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how do you know when you're not responsible, what age or what?
Well, I think she's asking, what age are you responsible when when you've been abused as a child? I think a lot of it is going to be doing your own writing, talking, because when did, you start using it for your benefit, and when was it abuse? Okay, I mean, when did it become a manipulation? Because that happens to a lot of people who have had those kind of violations, that it ends up, they've been violated and they turn it around and then they become the violator. That's a normal reaction to that kind of abuse. And I think a lot of it's going to be in your own writings, and a lot of it is talking it over with someone else. You know, these are heavy issues, and that's why it's so necessary to work these issues out with an AA sponsor, with a minister, with a counselor, whoever you can, can work with. Because at some point, you're going to still today have to take responsibility to your reactions today from what happened. But when is it a reaction to what happened, and when does it become your action? And I think those are the kind of things that each person will be different. You know, some people are 17 years old and they don't have any more responsibility than a 5-year-old. And then there are some people who are 10 years old and they have a maturity level that is far and away different. So every person is different.
I think you need to be really careful with that subject, because I don't care how much your 10-year-old is. If you're living in a household with your parents and living in
abuse,
you're still
having
a certain power over you.
Right, exactly.
I don't think anybody should make the mistake of thinking that they're responsible 21 years old, just still living in that house, and still under the control of that person and manipulating that person.
Okay, she said she doesn't believe that anybody should have to take responsibility. Even if a child is 10 years old, they're still under the control of the parents. And even if they're living in the house and they're 21 years old, they're still under the control of the parent. I have a little bit of disagreement with part of that. But
at,
right, exactly. Well, that's what I'm trying to say to her. It's different for different people, and that's what she's saying. Just because somebody is 21 years old and they've been in that house and they've been groomed by that parent, just because they turn 18 doesn't instantly make them an adult. I couldn't agree with that more. I totally agree with that. And that's why I think that each person needs to do... See, some people leave home at 13 years old, and maybe they do something different. Some people are trapped in a house, and they may be 30 and no more responsible for their actions than a 9-year-old. So I think all of those things are something that needs to be weighed. It's an individual thing. You know, I totally agree with you. Because, see, you don't know how that person... I mean, it's kind of like being in a concentration camp, you know. You don't know any better unless you've been out of the concentration camp. If you've never been out, you don't know there's anything but the concentration camp. Yes?
I grew up in that home.
Right.
I can tell you that I have most people I know after that we're looking inside ourselves and know what changed.
Exactly.
I know for myself what changed from somebody using me to somebody else. And I have had to go back, but you all have to.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what it is, it's used to be able to say, I did this, I'm responsible, I was wrong. You know, and it works. It's done on that person. And it is a hard thing.
It is. It's a very difficult thing to do, Jill. And she's saying, you know, that this happened to her. And as you do the work, you know when it changed, when you changed from being a victim until you changed to being the offender. We all know where that change happens. And I think it's true. Little kids, if there's something going wrong in your house, you do. You know that because a child is self-centered. That's the way a child is supposed to be. So if all this horridity is going on in your house, you know for sure that you're responsible for it. So as a child, sometimes we take total responsibility and don't even see that we're a victim. So all of this stuff, it takes time to sort it out. Because I did. I just knew that my daddy was angry, hitting on my mother because of something I did.
See, that's what the steps are all
about. Right.
And I am personally responsible for raising him to be elected. I know.
Right, exactly. Right. Right. And where does it begin and end? And I think that's all about what recovery is. And it's really hard because it's a difficult place, and some of us have a lot of hurt to work through. And to know what am I responsible for? What am I not responsible for? And where did I have no power and no control? What was I powerless over? And what does the book say? My dilemma was a lack of power. And a little child is certainly in that dilemma. Even though I may feel like I had so much power that family was totally doing all those things and I was responsible. That's the way I felt, that I was responsible. And you know, it's like this is such a generality. And what happens is we're talking in generalities about those are heavy issues. We're talking in a generality about very personal things. And it's really hard to put, you know, it needs to be discussed on an individual basis. That's why you don't go do fifth steps and come to the podium and tell them. You sit down one-on-one because everybody's life is different. Everybody's issues are different. And it can become, you know, people can become enraged when you talk in generalities because they're saying, wait a minute, you don't know what happened to me. And it's like, yeah, we need to wait a minute. We don't know what happened to them so that we can stop and listen to that.
I'm wondering if you see any difference between an Al-Anon inventory and an AA inventory. And if you have done an Al-Anon inventory, I ask that because in our, what's basically our 12x12, one of the points that's made is that an inventory makes an accounting of everything that's in the store,
mm-hmm.
including those things which are our assets, or things we can draw from,
mm-hmm.
we can draw from, we may not have recognized, and that we may in fact undervalue. As a sponsor in Al-Anon, I have a lot of interest, and this happened to me when I did my own, that part of my disease, which is martyrdom and self-blame, just goes for it, is doing an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can find so much that is wrong, right? In the past, it's been true. But when I'm working with kids in the Al-Anon program, I find that the sense of depression, of debilitation, this exaggerated view of one's own negativity is kind of, it's really rooted in many Al-Anon people that I know. And so, you've been talking and addressing the AA side. I'm kind of feeling that maybe you've been intended to say Al-Anon and AA. But I just wonder if you have any insights about that, about those differences.
Okay, she's talking about an Al-Anon inventory. And have I taken an Al-Anon inventory? I want to answer yes to that. And is there any difference? And I don't believe that there is any difference. I am very, very clear for me. Now, this may not be clear for anybody else, that you sober up an alcoholic and you have got a flaming Al-Anon. Because what is the difference? What is the difference? One of us drank and one of us didn't. But once we get through with the drinking, I believe all of the emotional sobriety is the same. And I think that then those things, now I can, there are many, many alcoholics who have just as much disease of perfectionism. Now we could sit here and start talking about perfectionism of the overeaters in here. Well, you talk about perfectionism comes with eating disorder. I mean, but I have perfectionism both from my AA disease and my disease of Al-Anon. And one of the things that I think is so necessary when we're doing inventories, which one more time is why I say it's not a generality, it's an individual thing, which is why we do it with people, is that somebody can say, stop already. You know, this is ceasing to be an inventory and it's starting to be a flagellation, okay? This is starting to be your character defect. We need to talk about this character defect you have of having this need to beat yourself up. So, what I am resentful at myself, I can't accept myself. Most of the things that I can't, that was the whole thing. I couldn't accept the imperfections in me. I had a hard time doing that, which is why I would go to a mirror and see nothing. I couldn't accept me. And I think those are part of the things that we need to work on. And I agree with you 100% because I can do that. I can do that here thinking, here I come to this conference, I should have all this stuff being prepared, and then I can just say, oh my God, I didn't have those copies, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, and I can get into that spiral one more time of what we're talking about, of just get out the whip and beat up on myself. I never knew what they talked about, that one man died on the cross, Polly, put yours down, because I would do the same thing. Needing to be right. And I don't think that that's an Al-Anon trait. This is my feelings. Now, there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that are never going to agree with me about it. You sober up an alcoholic and you got a flaming Al-Anon, but they don't want to believe they have anything to do with Al-Anons. I am a caretaker of people. Now, I drank alcohol to the point that I was pronounced dead on arrival with the disease, yet I am still a caretaker of people. Now, what is an Al-Anon? A caretaker of people. Now, there may not, some of us AA women may not be that, but I believe a lot of us are. What I can't understand is how did you live through it without a drink?
Yeah.
that much pain by God, I'd take a drink. That's always been a mystery to me. Yes. She asked if codependency meetings were the same as Al-Anon meetings. To tell you the truth, I do not know. I believe that they're similar, and I believe that there are people in there who do not come from alcoholic, you know, homes, but maybe they come from, you know, like workaholism and, you know, a lot of, you know, gamblers and workaholics and all of those things. That's just, you know, anything that separates you emotionally from the people you love and care for. It's you know, and I think that's what codependency is all about in their meetings. So I know they use the 12 steps. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. It's when helping others. When she says Julie is saying that the codependency meetings are all, you know, are a lot the same, but it's all about the same as Al-Anon. When helping you starts to hurt me. And one of the things that I like to remember as an AA sponsor, which I think has a lot to do with my Al-Anon and where I learned, was when I start putting more into your program than you put into your program, we need to talk about it. Because I can end up working more on your program than you work on it. And I find myself doing that a lot. So I have had to learn to detach. And that was really hard for me to do. And allow you to not get sober or not get better if that's what you choose to do. It is absolutely your choice. But see, I was so eager to have people absolutely get better no matter what, that I felt like I had to do it. And today I have to realize my husband says something that helped me so much. And he said, Polly, you don't have the right to deny somebody their pain because that pain is what will get them better. And Bill says, and as Bill sees it, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. Yes. I love it. I love it, E.T. That's great. She said, if alcoholics are looked at as selfish and self-centered people, are Al-Anons looked at that way too? Go ask an Al-Anon what their primary purpose was. Their primary purpose is to say, look what I've done for you. Without me, you'd never make it. And see, that's who I was too. My poor husband who's got congestive heart failure. I'm walking around in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober alcoholics, saying, he'll die if I don't take care of him. Yes. Sure they do. And she's asked, do not men have that same dual thing? I mean, I just shared with somebody yesterday who's having a lot of problems because of that. It's the same thing. Men have it just like, you know, one of the things I know that, you know, we're doing a lot of growing as women. And we're doing a lot of changing as women. But I'm here to tell you that alcoholism, Al-Anonism, and all this is not gender biased. It has nothing to do with gender. Now, what happened was, it just, you know, women were alcoholics always, but we were hidden. Thank God alcoholism was out in the open, or I would have died from the disease of alcoholism, because I was not out where people could see me. Like a man who went to work every day. I was a real estate agent, and, you know, I was pretty autonomous, had a lot of autonomy. But men have these same problems. When it comes to disease, this disease, alcoholism, the disease, and alcoholism, it's where the alcoholism is about drinking or not drinking. Al-Anon is about the disease of alcoholism. And the book is very clear to say that alcohol is but a symptom. The disease is the ism. If alcoholism was just about drinking, then detox centers would send out sober people, never to have to deal with anything again. Alcohol is what we do because of what's going on. The difference is the Al-Anons have the same thing going on, they just don't drink. I never understood that, but they don't drink. They have other things. I mean, they get satisfaction other ways. But men have that too. It's the same.
I tried, when my husband drank, I tried to drink with it. And it didn't give me a
therapist
mm-hmm. being used.
Right.
All that did was put me to sleep.
Right. And she's saying that she tried to drink with her husband and it didn't do for her what it did for me. And that's true. That's the difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. Because alcohol, see, everybody's always saying, Polly, look what alcohol does to you. But I'm trying to scream, you don't know what it does for me. Because it didn't do for you. And it's just like these things we have about, you know, legal drinking and illegal drinking. Non-alcoholics don't build a tolerance. So they don't, I mean, they can't drink enough to blow a .10. So when people start saying, I just had a bad day, bullshit. They built a tolerance. You threw up once if you drank too much and you said, well, I'll never do that again. Not me. We'll just do it till we get it right. We'll just keep trying. This feels too good. I'm not about to give it up. So, but you, what we're talking about is after you remove the chemical, after we're sober, sitting in rooms like this, this is what I love about woman to woman, that when we get rid of the chemical and we're left with the feelings are the same. And I believe that with all my heart. Now, you may disagree with me. That's my opinion. That's not in the book. So that's my opinion. But I think when we get rid of that and what's left, we feel alike. Now, we come to step 10. 10, 11, and 12 have been called the maintenance steps. And in 10, it says, continue to take personal inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Now, what that does for me is it says, I take an inventory. So that means that if I don't need to write it out, maybe I can just think about it, you know, as I lay down and go to sleep at night. But sometimes I may need to put it on paper. Because I can tell you that there are days that I can build some big resentments. Somebody can do something to me, hurt my feelings, step on my toe, and I'm truly pissed off. And I need to write it out, just like we did here. I need to, you know, I am resentful, what's the cause, and take a look at it. Because I'm so biased as to what they've done to me, I can't see my part in it. So I need to write it out. And then when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. What is that? Step 9. So what happens is step 10 keeps me up to date. Step 10 keeps me living in the here and now. And if I continue to take personal inventory, and if I work step 10 on a daily basis, probably I'm not going to have to go back and take an in-depth fourth and fifth step again. But if I don't stay current, and it's just like, you know, if I don't do an inventory on a pretty much daily basis, then here late I'm going to, you know, pile it up. And that happens to me. I'll let it stack up because I'm in the human condition. I have not been anointed sainthood. And I let it stack up and I have to go back and do a whole fourth and fifth again. Because pretty soon I'm mad at him, her, it, that. And I've got all this stuff going. And a tenth step just ain't going to do it. But keep abreast. And then it doesn't pile up so much. And I'm not a person, it's like I don't believe that for me, some people need to take a fourth and fifth every year. I personally don't do that. I personally have taken 2 in 15 years. I try to stay current with 10. I try to make 10 something I do on a daily basis. Yes?
What do you do about resentment towards yourself? Where you violated your own belief that you like gossiping, as an example, where you've done something that you don't feel good about?
Mm-hmm. Who am I angry at? Me, my behavior. You know, I'm angry at me. What's the cause? Because I talk about people behind their back. What does that affect? It affects my self-esteem. It affects my personal relationships. I mean, it chews me up. And then what am I looking for? I'm self-seeking. I'm dishonest. You know, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for you to like me better than them. I'm self-seeking. And then I have to go up and, you know, tell that person. You know, I said some things about you that aren't true, and I'm really sorry. And how I follow through with that is I go tell the other person that I told that I did it. That's sometimes even harder. Oh, guess what? But I told you it's not true. God, I hate that stuff. I get so in touch with how prideful I am.
That reminds me of interesting because I didn't
want
to drink. I just don't like
this and I don't think this is she said she doesn't like to make amends for the things she's done while she was drinking. She just doesn't like to make amends for the things she's done now. Well, one of the things that about me and my drinking is I was one of these people that laid on my sofa. So what I did is I did a lot of damage to my family. Now that I'm sober, I run havoc through everybody's life. So I get to make amends a lot. I do worse with the here and now than I did with the, you know, than I had with the past. Sometimes I'll say, but by God, I'm sober. How could I have done this? I have a program. I'm on a spiritual path. How did that happen? As a guy said, if you're not making any mistakes today, you're not doing enough. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sue Ellen says it's back to that thing that we were talking about with Keith L. that says it's a spiritual experience to admit when you're wrong, and when you say I'm sorry, it's a spiritual experience. I understand that because sometimes it just... I want to justify it so bad because I mean, that is my disease. I just have this need to be right. And it's okay to be wrong because if I'm wrong, it means I can learn. If I'm always right, I have nothing to learn. That humility again. Right, to be humble. And that's it. And that's the main thing. The more slack, that's the main thing point I want to make too, Sue Ellen. The main thing is the more slack you cut yourself, the more slack you'll cut other people. And the more you can get in touch with your own, you know, shortcomings, that's the main thing. If you get in touch with your own shortcomings, and then you can let other people have shortcomings too. Because it's back to that old thing, you cannot give away what you don't have. And if you don't have any forgiveness of self and don't have any letting up on yourself, then we don't let up on others. We have too high expectation on other people. Right, rule 62, just don't take yourself so damn seriously.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I love them when I'm crazy out there, but that's who I am. A lot of them still. You know, and when I try to, like, give them all God and forget about it,
mm-hmm.
You know, they're not really there that day. In some cases, it's still real strong enough to be that bad. You know. And then, just like, I kind of figure that if God can take the good and the bad, then why can't I?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not God here. And that has really helped me a lot to embrace.
She's talking about the seven-step prayer, that it's really helped her to let up on herself and to accept herself and to accept her character defects. One of the things that I just love what she said, because I think a lot of times when we read the seven-step prayer that we forget about that, you know, last night I was talking about everybody makes a difference. And we talk about it in the seven-step prayer. It says, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. You know, I may have some character defects going on that God needs for me to have. Because he's using them. And that was pointed out to me. And until that was pointed out to me, it's like, oh my God. So see, we go back to, if we truly take a step seven, it's not any of my business what God removes. Because there may be something there, you know, me going back and gossiping and keep making amends may be some kind of example to people who are gossiping and not making amends. Everything is of use to God. There is no negatives. But my perception of it, I may not see it that way. But you are absolutely right. And that reminded me of that. Because God is using that. Every bit of me, the good and the bad. And the only person that's judging the good and the bad is me. That bad may be working for God perfectly. Have you ever sat in a meeting and seen somebody doing something and knew that's what you didn't want to do? And that what they did was as much benefit to you as if they were doing everything right? You betcha. You betcha. Exactly. It works. So when we take a seventh step, that's all. The seventh step is so, we do this, we say this prayer, and the seventh step says, we have then completed step seven. And I hear people walking around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous say, I'm working on my character defect. How do you do that? She said with a blood instrument. I love it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to continue my conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. And one of the things that I try to do is I try to read some readings. My husband and I do this together in the morning. And we try to read some readings and to just sit quietly. And I love what I've heard in AA and Al-Anon meetings that prayer is when I ask God and when I talk to God, and meditation is when I listen. And sometimes I often say God has never sent me a fax, so I don't get, you know, messages that way. But usually what happens is I'll pray to God and I'll ask for some guidance, and lo and behold, from left field, from God knows where, here comes somebody with the answer. And it is I can see God working in my life constantly like that. It just happens. I ask for help, and I just invariably get it. It never comes the way I thought it would come. It always comes in very mysterious ways. But I always get the answers that I need if I ask. And what I try to do is do just what the book says, to be of maximum service to God and others. And I truly believe that God answers prayers. I just believe that with all my heart, that God answers prayers. And I believe that there's power in prayers. And when I have, you know, something going on, I ask people to pray. I used to stand behind podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous and ask for people to pray for my son, Russ. And I know without a doubt that the very reason that he's doing as well as he's doing today is because of the prayers that were sent up in rooms just like this. I believe in the power of prayer. And I believe that he answers the prayer. And there's a lot of people who get more direct, you know, messages from God. For me, God, as I understand him, speaks to me through the people. That's the way it works for me. And there will be times when I have these intuitive feelings, but what I try to do is discuss them with another person. And it just keeps going on. And once I was told, every time you mention God or your higher power, that is a conscious contact. So it doesn't have to be just in the morning or just at night. You can talk to God as you understand him all day long. But any time you do that, it's a conscious contact. The 12 steps says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. I know today that why I have the things I have is a direct result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That it's taking a set of actions that is necessary to produce a spiritual awakening. And I truly believe that the 11 steps is action that can produce a spiritual awakening. There has been a lot of times that I have had to take actions contrary to the way I felt. But by taking those actions, you know, just because I feel like I don't want to do it doesn't mean I don't do it. But taking those actions And that is what is necessary to produce a spiritual awakening. And then what I do is I go practice these principles in all my affairs. And I'm here to tell you, it is not tough for me to be spiritual and wonderful in this room. It's real easy. But I guarantee you, when I get on an L.A. freeway, sometimes it gets real hard not to flip a guy off. It's real hard to practice these principles in all my affairs. That's when my program is at the test. And I can tell you where it becomes the greatest test is when I take this program into my marriage. Because the person that I tend to abuse and neglect and to do the less and to do my program the least with is my husband. I have time for everybody I sponsor. I have time for all of this stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll look around, and the one person that I haven't taken any time for is Dave. And I'm pulled up short on that many a time. But you see, that's what I do, because I have to be reminded of that character defect of my fear of intimacy. That the person I love the most tends to be the person I neglect the most. So it becomes real necessary for me to practice these principles at home with Dave. And then when I go out on a freeway to try to be nice and say, certainly, you can come in. Move right in. Oh, hello. Thank you. And I grow a little bit when I can do that. So, okay, the next session that we're going to do, we're going to talk on we're going to talk about emotional sobriety and some of the things that are defects and what the remedies are. And then we're going to talk about doing some writing, not inventory writing, just writing, so that we can get... There's a lot of things that we have intuitively that come to us, and it can come in writing. And we'll do that this evening. That's what I asked for the extra 15 minutes for, because you know you can't put that on tape. We're going to do that after we do the speaking. Does anybody else have anything that they want to add? Yes. Okay. Everybody stay put after this meeting. We have some announcements. Is there any? And Laura has one. Is there anything else before we can shut this one down? Anybody have anything else to add? Thank you, ladies. We'll see you tonight. Have fun this afternoon.